Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Bomb threat closes public schools in Los Angeles. Public schools across Los Angeles and the state of California have been closed due to a threat. The precise nature of the threat is unknown. Los Angeles Unified School District Superintendent Ramon Cortines said, "It is important that I take that precaution based on what has happened recently and what has happened in the past." He said the FBI has been notified and the threat is being analyzed. Authorities say all students who are already in school Tuesday morning were being sent home. The Los Angeles Unified School District has more than 640,000 students in kindergarten through 12th grade at more than 900 schools. President Obama says he remains confident the U.S.-led coalition will prevail in its battle against the Islamic State, insisting the Sunni terrorist organization is losing ground and leaders.
Coalition aircraft, our fighters, bombers, and drones have been increasing the pace of airstrikes, nearly 9,000 as of today.
Mr. Obama announced no change in strategy, but said coalition forces will continue to train and equip Iraqi forces. Saying he hoped they'd be able to find some common ground, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry sat down for talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on Tuesday. Both officials said the crisis in Syria, the Islamic State, and the unrest in Ukraine would be focal points during their meeting in Moscow, which marks Mr. Kerry's second trip to the country this year.
Nothing would please us more than to resolve the differences of Ukraine and be able to move forward in the economic front and on other areas of important cooperation.
Speaking through a translator, Mr. Lavrov said he wanted to continue the dialogue initiated by Russian President Vladimir Putin and U.S. President Barack Obama on how the U.S. could assist in the Ukrainian settlement. This is VOA News. The UN's nuclear watchdog is expected Tuesday to officially close its more than decade-old investigation into allegations that Iran once worked to develop nuclear weapons. International Atomic Energy Agency Chief Yukiya Amano said that it was a clear conclusion that Iran carried out a range of activities relevant to the development of a nuclear explosive device, mostly before 2003. He said those activities did not get beyond scientific studies and acquiring certain relevant technical competencies and capabilities. Tuesday marks 2 years since the start of the civil war in South Sudan. A peace deal was signed in August, but implementation has been slow and complicated by continued disagreements. From Addis Ababa, Marta Vanderwolf checks in on where things stand.
Peace talks for South Sudan have resulted in many agreements over the past 2 years, but that hasn't stopped more than 2 million people from being displaced and tens of thousands more being killed. Humanitarian agencies says 4 million South Sudanese are at risk for food shortages, with many facing possible starvation. Kesut Gebre Egzabir of the United Nations Refugee Agency says funding is also a problem.
The funding situation is really very precarious, and we hope the donor community, international community, will support us better in 2016.
A political rift between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar turned violent 2 years ago. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Ethiopia has been hosting peace talks. Kenya is hosting the ministerial conference of the World Trade Organization. Delegates had hoped this round of the Doha trade negotiations would yield a breakthrough in efforts to address trade imbalances between developed and developing nations. But once again, a far-reaching resolution looks unlikely. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
The World Trade Organization launched the Doha Development Agenda in 2001, and the negotiations have now lasted over 14 years. The Doha Agenda seeks to remove trade barriers to help developing countries better integrate into the global economy. Deodat Maharaj is Deputy Secretary General of the Commonwealth.
You can't trade effectively if it is that you don't tap the sum total of your entire market. We need to open up corridors.
A key debate ahead of this year's ministerial conference has been whether to continue the now 14-year process or to start fresh. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
The four-day ministerial conference ends on Friday. For more on all these stories, visit our websites at voanews.com. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Officials in Burundi say refugees in neighboring Rwanda are being recruited to fight against the Burundian government. And they accuse Rwanda of aiding the rebels. The allegation heightens regional tensions as political violence in Burundi escalates.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details coming up.
Also in the news, today marks 2 years since the start of the civil war in South Sudan, and the Nigerian army says it has taken into custody the leader of the Islamic movement of Nigeria after the group allegedly attacked the convoy of Nigeria's army chief.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, officials in Burundi say refugees in neighboring Rwanda are being recruited to fight against the Burundian government, and they accuse Rwanda of aiding the rebels. The allegation heightens regional tension as political violence in Burundi escalates. VOA's Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
Burundian presidential adviser Willy Nyamitwe told VOA his government has proof that Burundian refugees have been recruited into armed groups. And he was quick to name the suspected culprit.
We have evidence that people are being trained in Rwanda. Some persons who came to attack Burundi last July that have been called by the army, they reveal that they have been trained in Rwanda. And all the plotters, the coup plotters, those who attempted the coup in last May, when they ran away, they went in Rwanda. So we do believe people are being trained in Rwanda, as well as weapons that are coming from Rwanda.
Nyamitwe said Burundi's government isn't ready to reveal what steps they may take next. Rwandan officials could not be reached despite repeated attempts seeking comment, but they have previously denied such allegations. The neighboring nations are culturally and ethnically similar, but tensions between the two leaders are nothing new. Rwandan President Paul Kagame was quick to condemn Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid to remain in power this year. Burundi's allegations come in response to a new report from advocacy group Refugees International, which says non-state armed groups in Rwanda are systematically recruiting desperate Burundians in Rwandan refugee camps. Michael Boyce, one of the report's authors, says researchers spoke to 80 refugees who said they had been recruited or trained by militant groups. Under international law, refugee camps must be exclusively civilian in nature. No military presence, recruitment, or activities are allowed. Boyce was quick to note that researchers did not find an ethnic angle to the recruitment. Researchers were also careful to avoid assigning blame, but did ask Rwandan authorities to step up.
These concerns about recruitment have been raised for months now, not simply by Burundi, but also by the media, by international officials at a very senior level. And yet, up until now, the recruitment continues. So we're asking Rwanda to address this seriously, to allow humanitarian workers, including the UN High Commission for Refugees, to engage with this problem, to protect refugees as they're mandated to do, because this problem doesn't seem to be going away, whatever efforts Rwanda may have taken to address it so far.
Burundi has suffered unrest since April, when Nkurunziza announced his intention to seek a third term in office, a move that critics say violated the constitution. But Nkurunziza weathered a May coup attempt and won a disputed election in July. And the strife has continued, peaking this past weekend when 87 people were killed after attackers stormed army installations in the capital. The United Nations Refugee Agency says more than 200,000 Burundians have fled into neighboring countries since the crisis began. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you, Anita. The UN Human Rights Council says it will hold a special session on violence in Burundi later this week. The session set for Thursday was called at the request of the United States and supported by 17 members of the Human Rights Council and 25 observer states. Only one African state, Ghana, supported the measure. This will be the first such special session the council convened to discuss terrorist attacks and human rights abuses by the terrorist organization Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. Thursday's session will consider a draft resolution asking the UN Human Rights Commissioner Zayed Rahad Al Hussein to send a team of international experts to Burundi within 45 days to investigate the violence and recommended steps to ease tensions. I spoke with reporter Hariamana Moses, who is on the ground in Bujumbura. He provided me with an update of the situation right now in the capital city.
Right now, it is a relative calm, but a little bit tense within the civilians being worried on what will be happening up next after the Friday's attack, which proves to be the bloodiest attack since President Nkurunziza, the protest against him started last April. So the heavy gunfire and exchanges of bullets have been happening on Friday morning, where many civilians have left their own lives. But according to the Burundian government, 87 people were killed during the confrontation between the armed group and the security forces. However, the human activists here in Burundi are saying that the figures could double as security forces confronted the armed group in the residential areas where many of the victims have been civilians in the recent attack. So there's a heavy deployment on the streets in and around Bujumbura capital with a lot of roadblocks, but it's relatively calm for now.
Do citizens feel like enough is being done to protect them?
It's very, very difficult because now the government have been accusing the armed group that they have made the civilians a human shield after attacking the army bases, which are based in the outskirts of Bujumbura. The two bases which were attacked on Friday, the armed group fled to their residential areas where civilians stayed. So all the confrontation of which lasted for more than 7 hours was inside the residential areas, where most especially the areas where protests against President Nkurunziza happened in April. So many youth and many people have been arrested and others have been killed. So people are not feeling really safe and they don't think that the government is doing enough to protect them as they confront the armed group.
The UN Human Rights Council is scheduled to meet there in Burundi later this week. What are the expectations from this meeting?
Yes, human rights have been releasing reports concerning about the human rights violations in Burundi, but little have been done since then because there have been allegations by the civil society organizations and also reports by the human rights organizations that there have been violations of human rights, torture, arbitral arrests, and also there have been actually killings within the civilians. So people are now currently, they don't know what's next going to be because what they say currently now is it's all about God and nothing is being done. They have been talking about dialogue, they have been talking about human rights, respect of the human rights, but little have been done on the ground since last April when the protest against President Nkurunziza happened.
What are people saying is going to stop the violence? What ultimately are they saying will stop the violence?
People currently are saying they have to dialogue, both sides, both parties, they have to dialogue and not to sort out their own issues concerning about the political issues. People are becoming more concerned about the dialogue, whether it will be fruitful or not, because the National Dialogue Commission, which is the opposition themselves, don't believe and don't trust in it, whereas the African Union and the East African Community, together with the UN, have proposed the Burundi government to resume dialogue under the President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda. So since that time, there have been a pull and push with the government of Uganda and Burundi, but enough hasn't it been done to resume this dialogue. As the head of the new team, which was set by a Burundi president, he's saying that the dialogue itself, the commission itself, it doesn't have enough funds to travel abroad to meet those who are the stakeholders in order to bring them on board to make an inclusive dialogue.
That was reporter Hariamana Moses. He spoke with me from Bujumbura.
Today marks 2 years since the start of the civil war in South Sudan. A peace deal was signed in August, but implementation has been slow and complicated by continued disagreements. From Addis Ababa, Martha van der Wolf checks in on where things stand.
Peace talks for South Sudan have resulted in many agreements over the past 2 years, but that hasn't stopped more than 2 million people from being displaced and tens of thousands more being killed. Humanitarian agencies says 4 million South Sudanese are at risk for food shortages, with many facing possible starvation. The international community of the Red Cross says continued fighting is making it hard to reach many civilians in need of food and medical care. Kisut Gebre-Egzabir of the United Nations Refugee Agency says funding is also a problem.
They requested for a little over $340 million, and this figure was only 20% funded until November. So you can see the gap. So we were forced to focus on life-saving activities only. The funding situation is really very precarious, and we hope the donor community, international community, will support us better in 2016.
A political rift between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar turned violent 2 years ago. The regional bloc IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, quickly established a mediation team after the conflict started. Dada Desta is a policy analyst at the Ethiopian International Institute for Peace and Development. He believes the intervention by IGAD might have prevented a possible genocide, but he is not impressed with how the peace negotiations were conducted.
It should have been done bottom-up, grassroots level mobilization and reconciliations. It should have included traditional values, and it should have helped the reconciliation and state building as a center of the whole process, which is not. It's just about power sharing, nothing else.
Desta says at this point it is too late to change course. Both sides have violated the ceasefire they agreed to in August. A transitional government was to be created in November but is delayed. A rebel advance team was to arrive in the capital, Juba, in early December, but the sides now disagree about the size of the team. Ethiopia has been hosting the talks, and regional heads of states have gotten personally involved several times trying to force a breakthrough. The spokesman of the Ethiopian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Tewolde Mulugeta, says the sides must make greater efforts to implement the accord.
It needs commitment on all parties. And that commitment should be forthcoming from everybody, because this is, you know, for the peace and development of South Sudan, for the peace and development of the South Sudanese people, and of course the region as well.
The UN Security Council has threatened more sanctions on those who violate or obstruct the peace deal. It has already slapped travel bans and asset freezes on 6 military leaders from both sides of the conflict. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Officials in Burundi say refugees in neighboring Rwanda are being recruited to fight against the Burundian government. And today marks 2 years since the start of the civil war in South Sudan. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A pacifist branch of a former Muslim rebel alliance says voting in Central African Republic's northern city of Kagabandoro went on despite death threats by a faction of Seleka rebels on Sunday. The results of a national referendum on a new constitution have not been announced yet, but leaders of the acting government said a large majority of the nation's 2 million voters turned out. The voting is required in order for a national election of a president and a parliament can take place on December 27th. Also in Kagabandoro, a rebel leader today declared an autonomous state in his northeastern stronghold and rejected the election process. Maulud Musa, a lieutenant for rebel leader Nordin Adam, told Reuters they want autonomy and declared the Republic of Lagane in tree town of Kagabandoro.
The Nigerian army says it has taken into custody the leader of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria after the group allegedly attacked the convoy of Nigeria's army chief. Major General Adeniyi Oyebode
told reporters yesterday that Ibrahim Zaki Zaki and his wife have been detained after military raids on at least three locations. Oyabade said Zakzaki was arrested in the northern city of Zaria in Kaduna State. He also said there were casualties on both sides after the raids Saturday and Sunday, but did not give an exact number. The Islamic Movement of Nigeria says soldiers killed up to 300 of its members in Zaria. Other reports put the death toll much lower at 20. Both sides confirmed that one of the raid sites was Zakzakia's home in Zaria. The Associated Press reports that two other sites were spiritual centers in Zaria. The violence began Saturday after members of the movement blocked a highway and, according to witnesses, stoned the convoy of General Tukur Burtai. An army spokesman called the stoning an attempt to assassinate the army leader. The Shiite group says there was no assassination attempt and that the army had launched a pre-planned attack on the group. It says troops launched attacks and killed people indiscriminately at three locations, including the home of the group's leader, Ibrahim Zakzaki. Zakzaki's son was reported among those killed. The Islamic Movement of Nigeria seeks to establish an Islamic state in northern Nigeria through an Iranian-style revolution. The group is not connected to Boko Haram, the Islamic radical sect, blamed for more than 10,000 deaths in Nigeria during the past 6 years.
Political opposition to German Chancellor Angela Merkel's liberal migrant policies have softened their argument for limiting the flow of migrants into the country. Ms. Merkel's most prominent domestic critic sent conciliatory signals today. Bavarian Governor Horst Seehofer welcomed the Chancellor's acknowledgement that an unabated influx would overburden Germany, while making clear he will keep up the pressure to cut new arrivals. Yesterday, Ms. Merkel pledged to reduce the number of refugees. She said Germany would be overburdened if refugees continue to arrive in such large numbers. While she didn't promise specific new action, that wording in a motion on refugee policy helped persuade party members to drop a demand for a specific refugee limit. Seehofer drew polite applause at a conference of Merkel's Conservative Christian Democratic Union a day after Merkel rallied her party behind her approach, winning a 9-minute standing ovation. In Washington, lawmakers are working on legislation to ensure a person's online presence is reviewed as part of the vetting process for a visa to enter the United States. The goal is to close security gaps that didn't pick up on one of the radicalized shooters in the San Bernardino, California attack who entered the country last year. A White House spokesman says the Obama administration has directed the Homeland Security and State Departments to review the process for screening people who apply for visas and to make specific recommendations to close security gaps in the U.S. visa system.
Cameroonian authorities are urging more northerners to join self-defense groups to fight Boko Haram. The call comes after several recent successes scored by the self-defense group working in collaboration with the military. The recruiters note the vigilantes intercepted and killed two young female suicide bombers in a border town this week. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Boubakari Alium lives in the town of Amchide that straddles the border of Cameroon and Nigeria. 2 years ago, Boko Haram fighters attacked the town and killed 30 people, including his father and only brother. The 27-year-old shop owner joined the community self-defense force.
We are in a jeep to travel our journey, that is...
He told VOA by phone that they are divided into teams that patrol the mountainous areas, villages, markets, mosques, and farms day and night. He says they ask all suspects to surrender from a distance and then call the military for intervention. But he says if a suspect reaches for anything, they shoot him with poisoned bows and arrows. He says they also report all strangers and suspected collaborators to the military. The Nigerian militant sect began attacking in northern Cameroon in late 2014 and has since also expanded attacks into Chad and Niger. In northern Cameroon, militants have routinely targeted civilians, burning and looting villages, planting landmines, and attacking markets and other public places with suicide bombers. Mamudu Aji, a community leader in Amchide, who recruits young people, says not everyone who asks to join the self-defense groups is admitted for fear of infiltration. He says they do background checks into applicants' morality and patriotism. He says they only recruit people from the area who have not traveled to be sure they have not been intoxicated with extremist ideas. He says that decision was taken after a retired policeman returned home and started collaborating with Boko Haram. Aji says the young men get some training from the military and have recently begun some joint patrols. The young men are asking for motorcycles and food to help them broaden and extend their patrols in the hills at the border. The governor of Far North Cameroon, Miji Yawa Bakari, says the government has made provisions in its 2016 budget to support the self-defense groups, but declined to give further details.
Je saisis de cette occasion pour saluer l'action ô combien brave.
He says he is congratulating all self-defense groups whose courage has drastically reduced the shock of Boko Haram attacks, and he is inviting everyone to emulate their example. He says the government will do everything it can to support the self-defense groups. The governor said about a dozen of the youth vigilantes have died in operations so far this year. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Kenya is hosting the Ministerial Conference of the World Trade Organization, the highest decision-making body within the WTO. Lenny Yuvaka reports from Nairobi.
The World Trade Organization launched the Doha Development Agenda in 2001, and the negotiations have now lasted over 14 years. The Doha Agenda seeks to remove trade barriers to help developing countries better integrate into the global economy. Deodat Maharaj is Deputy Secretary General of the Commonwealth, which represents 53 countries, including India and several large economies in sub-Saharan Africa. He says trade imbalances in Africa must first be addressed by internal policy changes.
You can't trade effectively if it is that you don't tap the sum total of your entire market. And to tap the sum total of the entire market of Africa, we need to open up corridors, economic corridors, so that trade from one country to another will be seamless.
A key debate ahead of this year's ministerial conference, known as Nairobi MC10, has been whether to continue the now 14-year process or to start fresh. The United States and Europe want the talks to begin on fresh ground. Nations like Kenya and South Africa want to see the Doha process through to the end. Kipyego Cheluget, Assistant Secretary General of the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa, COMESA, says there is lots to resolve.
This is a continuous process, a very, very difficult and complicated one. So I'm not really so sure that we can confidently say that after Nairobi MC10, all the problems that we have will be resolved. I think it might really be like the beginning of a process that will perhaps address some of our challenges.
A push from developing nations to remove agricultural subsidies in rich countries is expected to be a top item on the agenda this week. Some accuse the WTO of favoring rich nations. Economist Yash Tandon, CEO of the Southern and Eastern Trade Information and Negotiations Institute, says the body does not hold solutions for Africa.
WTO is asymmetrical, unequal, and the power is held by the Western countries in league with the Secretariat of the WTO, which is totally biased against as in us. So in that kind of climate where they are pushing for what's called free trade is totally unbalanced against us.
The four-day ministerial conference ends Friday. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Officials in Burundi say refugees in neighboring Rwanda are being recruited to fight against the Burundian government today. Today marks 2 years since the start of the civil war in South Sudan, and the Nigerian army says it has taken into custody the leader of the Islamic movement of Nigeria after the group allegedly attacked the convoy of Nigeria's army chief. Coming up, music from Cameroon, and in our feature segment, the Lake Chad area severely impacted by insecurity from Boko Haram-linked attacks. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhi Band. We're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Kim, and welcome back.
Thank you very much, Sunny. And I understand you are kicking off with some African football awards.
Kim, joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Seasonal sporty greetings, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, we're in the end-of-year award season. And on that note, the Confederation of African Football winnowing its lists for its major awards. How about an update for our VOA football fans?
Certainly, Sonny. And the big one, of course, is the African Footballer of the Year. That's the greatest individual honor that can be bestowed on any African footballer within Africa. Our older listeners will remember way back in 1995, we had that sensational year for Africa when George Weah from Liberia, he won not only the African Footballer of the Year, he also won the European Footballer of the Year and the World Footballer of the Year. But as far as awards in Africa are concerned, the African Footballer of the Year is the big one. We're down to the final three, Sonny, and no real surprises. It's Yaya Toure, who's bidding for an amazing fifth straight title. He's already got the record with four in a row. The previous record was Samuel Eto'o of Cameroon with three in a row, so that's been overtaken. And Yaya Toure, Sonny, he's threatening to just go down in history because it's going to be very difficult to match five in a row. But he's got to be the favorite. And he's up against Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, a person we mention almost weekly on the Sunny Side of Sport because every week he seems to be banging in goals in Germany for Borussia Dortmund. And then André Ayew formerly played in France. He's now playing very well for Swansea in England. And, of course, he is one of the sons of the legendary Ghanaian Abede Pele. I've also had quite a few emails, Sonny, on the issue of Mahrez, the player who got the hat-trick just last weekend for Leicester City. And I think we've got to put him in the unlucky file. I think his recent form has been outstanding. But, of course, some of these selections were made just a little while ago. So I think the timing, he may have been a victim of that. But I think, Sonny, truthfully, I would have him in my top three with Aubameyang and Yaya Toure. I think Yaya Toure is the favorite. And my prediction is that Aubameyang will, for the second year in a row, will be the runner-up. But his turn will come if he keeps on banging in those goals. The second award, Sonny, is the Africa-based Football of the Year. A complaint in the past has been because most, if not all, of the top African footballers are actually playing overseas, that the Africa-based stars were being ignored. To rectify this problem, they brought in this Africa-based award. And I guess, again, not surprisingly, two of the three finalists are coming from TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo. They are, of course, the winners this year of the CAF Champions League. One is the veteran goalkeeper, Robert Kidiaba. He's now 39 years of age, and he is, of course, famous for the bouncing bottom goal celebration. Initially, he was well known to Africans, and then in 2010, became known worldwide when he did it during the FIFA Club World Cup. The other Mazembe player is Mbwana Samata. He is a Tanzanian, and he was the joint leading scorer this year in the Champions League. The third finalist is Baghdad Bounedjad. He is an Algerian. He plays for Etoile Sahel of Tunisia. And it was his goal to play the key role in Etoile Sahel winning the CAF Confederation Cup this year. I see it, Sonny, as a straight fight between Samata and Kidiaba. I think sentiment might sway it towards Kidiaba, but on pure form, I think Samata would be a deserving winner of that award. If we turn then to the team award, and here it's really interesting because of the five selections, three are underage teams. You've got the Mali under-17 team, you've got the Nigeria under-17 team. A reminder that they were the teams that fought it out for the FIFA under-17 World Cup, Nigeria winning 2-0. You've then got the Nigerian under-23 team, bronze medalists at the African Games in Congo-Brazzaville, and much more recently, the winners of the Olympic Games qualifying tournament in Senegal. Then, again, predictably, you've got the Ivory Coast and Ghana senior teams. They are the two countries who contested the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations final, Ivory Coast winning after extra time in a penalty shootout. So you have to say, Sonny, when it comes to the team award, very deserving finalists, and it's going to be difficult to decide there. We've also got five contenders for the coach of the year. You've got the two under-17 FIFA World Cup coaches, Emmanuel Amuniki of Nigeria and Bayi Ba of Mali. You've got Fawzi Benzati. He's the veteran Tunisian who guided Etoile Sahel to the Confederation Cup title. You've got Herve Renard, a Frenchman, the only person to guide two different countries to the Africa Cup of Nations title. He did it in 2012 with Zambia, and he did it this year with the Ivory Coast. And another Frenchman in contention, Patrice Carteron, he guided Mazembe to the 2015 CAF Champions League title. So keen competition there as well. You also, Sonny, have an award called the Most Promising Prospects. And among the five finalists are Ferhat of Algeria, a man we mentioned an awful lot, Rabah of Egypt. You've also got Diarra of Mali. But sadly, in my opinion, no place for Farouk Mia of Uganda. And I'm just wondering if he's suffering because he's not what one of the big countries of African football. My case for Mia is as follows. He scored three of the four goals in a World Cup qualifier against Togo. At the age of 17, he captained the Ugandan senior national team, and he's now 18 years of age. I think he's an outstanding prospect. And while I'm not saying he deserves to win the award, I would have liked to have seen him among the five finalists. You know, East African football, it needs all the encouragement it can get. It is the Cinderella region in the continent. I certainly think in the years to come, we're going to hear a lot more about Farouk Mia, who plays for the Vipers Club in Uganda. But I'm wondering just how much longer he'll be with them before he's whisked off to some European team. So that, Sonny, is a summary of the CAF Awards. The awards ceremony itself will be held in early January in Abuja, the capital of Nigeria.
David, you mentioned how Riyad Mahrez's recent form has been outstanding, and you would include him in your final three for the 2015 African Footballer of the Year Award. The 24-year-old Algerian, along with Leicester teammate Jamie Vardy, are part of what's being described as English football's most lethal double act. And the dynamic duo struck again on Monday. Vardy bagged his league-leading 15th goal of the season, while Mahrez scored his 11th to propel host Leicester to a 2-1 victory over stumbling champion Chelsea. The win keeps the surprising Foxes of Leicester at the top of the EPL standings. After only narrowly avoiding relegation during the last campaign, Leicester now leads Arsenal by 2 points and Manchester City by 3 points. Frenchman Loic Remy scored for Chelsea, which has lost 9 of its 16 league matches and is amazingly just 1 point from the relegation zone. Hey, I think the old sports emperor is in the house again.
Hey, g'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively sunny man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoja here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brillafm.net. I tell you this. It's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
American tennis star Serena Williams has been named Sports Person of the Year by Sports Illustrated, the premier sports magazine here in the United States. The 34-year-old Williams defied her age in 2015, winning 53 matches and losing only three. Serena also won three of the four major tennis tournaments, the Australian and French Opens, and Wimbledon. She fell short of her quest for the calendar year Grand Slam when she lost in the semifinals of the U.S. Open in September. For 6 weeks during the summer, Serena achieved a first in the history of the Women's Tennis Association rankings. She compiled so many rating points that she had twice as many as the world number two. And incredibly, at one point, the gap between her and number two was greater than that between number two and number 1,000. In other words, she dominated. She dominated women's tennis. The magazine's cover photo of Serena Williams this week was her own inspiration, according to managing editor Christian Stone. It shows Serena in high heels, in a one-piece black lace leotard, sitting on a gold throne with one of her bare legs over an arm of the chair. Stone says it was intended to express her own ideal of femininity, strength, and power. Serena Williams is the first female to be honored with the Sports Illustrated Award in 32 years. Double Olympic champion runner Mary Decker of the USA won the award in 1983. Serena Williams is also the first individual black woman to be honored since the award began in 1954. Congratulations, Serena! I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, world attention focusing in recent weeks on the thousands of Syrian refugees trying to reach peace and safety in Europe. And next, the Lake Chad area, severely impacted by insecurity from Boko Haram-linked attacks. But first, some music. Here is Ntomba from Cameroon with Sherry Coco.
Des bijoux, tu sais qu'elle a fait comment? Elle a un chat.
la fait comment?
With Sherry Coco.
While world attention has focused in recent weeks on the thousands of Syrian refugees trying to reach peace and safety in Europe, but several refugee crises, some of them decades old, continue in sub-Saharan Africa. Millions seek refuge from conflict in Somalia, the DRC, Sudan, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and other trouble spots. Some refugees have been living in camps as long as 20 years. Determining the legal status of refugee families and getting them resettled in the United States is a complex process. To find out more about how that's done, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with William Haney of Church World Service, a New York-based NGO that helps process and resettle refugees from over 35 sub-Saharan nations.
The interviews that we do with refugees destined for the United States is actually quite extensive. We have several different rounds of interviews where we ask them about who they are, why they fled, and they really have to be able to prove that they're a refugee under the 1951 Refugee Convention and also under U.S. law. All the refugees that we dealt with in sub-Saharan Africa are ones that had already fled their country of origin, whether that be Somalia, Congo, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and now they're in their country of asylum. That is usually either Kenya, Ethiopia, or elsewhere around sub-Saharan Africa. We processed in about 35 different countries this last year, so that means going out on location to interview refugees, whether in camps or urban locations, basically from coast to coast on the continent.
So what you do is you ease their passage to the United States to be absorbed?
Yeah, so the process to come to the United States involves lots of different steps and interviews. It involves background checks. It involves medical checks. And eventually cultural orientation before they arrive in the United States. And that last stage is teaching them about, you know, what's life going to be like in the United States. Basic things like grocery shopping. What are bathrooms like? You know, a lot of times those are different over in sub-Saharan Africa. So being able to kind of give people at least the basics before they arrive so that they can have a better start when they get here to the U.S. Many of the refugees coming from sub-Saharan Africa have never been on an airplane. So in our offices over in Kenya, we actually have real-life models of airline seats that have been donated by airlines to teach, you know, refugees how to use a seatbelt on an airline, what to do in the seat, about the signs that they're going to experience on the airline, all those different types of things to kind of prepare them for what for many of them will be 14, 15 hours straight in an airplane. Also related to the food that they're going to try, the different things that they're going to eat, and how to help manage their children and their relatives in this process of, you know, transiting through airports, going through Europe. You know, it's all just a very big process that many of them have never experienced before.
I understand from what you're saying that there's lots of very concrete, practical things to discuss. But of course, many of these people are extremely traumatized. I'm wondering if there's any kind of self-care tips that you give people more than simply referring them to other people down the road.
Well, one of the things I think that helps with refugees when they arrive to the United States is really being able to make friends and connect with local communities. So we try to partner refugees when they arrive in the United States with local volunteers, with local places of worship. Making a friend in the United States is the easiest and quickest way, one, to learn English, and two, to kind of learn more about the communities that they're resettling in and to really integrate in a way that is going to help in the long run. Many of the refugees have spent years in a camp. On average, about 20 years are spent in camp life before they're resettled to the United States. It's really a huge amount of time. And so just way of life in a camp can be traumatizing in itself.
Are there any kind of sort of homegrown African traditions that you can use to help them understand and relate to their own situation?
Yeah, I think the concept of African hospitality is certainly key in refugees understanding what life is going to be like in the United States. I think many people from Africa can completely understand the relationships, especially the family relationships that go on, the need to support relatives, the need to care for the elderly, the need to kind of be a family unit and to really everybody to pitch in when they arrive in the United States. So that's one of the things that we really look for, especially with families from Africa, is that they understand this concept of unity, of families kind of getting together and sharing. From my time speaking with different refugees in the camps, one of their biggest, you know, hopes and dreams is actually to find a job. A lot of them, you know, have been not able to work for years. One, because they're not provided work visas in the camps. They're only allowed to, you know, find temporary employment, whether that's pushing a wheelbarrow, whether it's selling things in a local shop. But it's very temporary work, and it doesn't pay very well. And so really for them to be able to come to the United States and find a job and be able to, you know, provide for their families and be self-sufficient within a short amount of time, that's really one of the greatest things for refugees, and it really provides them, you know, the dignity, you know, and just the family unity that they're looking for.
You really love this kind of work, don't you?
Absolutely. Definitely love this kind of work. So seeing refugees come in nowadays, it warms my heart. It makes me feel proud of the work that we're doing, proud of the work that the United States is part of, and I hope that we can increase it even more in the future.
Representatives from various United Nations agencies recently visited refugee sites and camps for internally displaced people in the towns of Bol and Bagassola in the Lake Chad area. The region has been severely impacted by insecurity from Boko Haram-linked attacks. Mary Ellen McGrothery, the World Food Programme country director for Chad, tells Ricky Shryock that the violence often carried out in marketplaces is increasing food insecurity for those already in need.
We visited some of the internally displaced sites and the refugee camp. You know, we were currently looking at an increased figure of internally displaced people as people flee the islands in Lake Chad for security on the mainland. We currently have a number of over 90,000. Could possibly increase following the weekend. These are just ordinary people who were living their lives on the islands, you know, fishing and farming, had to flee and leave everything behind, and now are totally dependent on the international community and the humanitarian sector in Chad. From a WFP perspective, we're providing food and nutrition assistance. In November, we reached over 68,000 people across 19 different sites. In December, we're looking at a further increase in that number across the UN system, is with the NGOs, is providing also shelter and water and sanitation and basic health services.
Recently, traders in Baga said that right now, on a good day, maybe 5 truckloads of fish are transported out of the town, whereas before, maybe 100 trucks a day would carry fish from the market out into the communities.
You know, for those people who have been displaced, they're severely food insecure. It's about 10-12% of the population. I mean, they have lost their livelihoods completely. The wider impact on the host community, and that were dependent also on the markets, and also, of course, those, you know, that traded through the markets. Of course, you mentioned, of course, the fish. Yes, severely impacted. And of course, the trade in animals as well has been severely impacted. The circle of disruption is widening. You know, I mean, it's not just those who are on the front lines of the insecurity. The attacks on the market as well start to remove the confidence, disturb the trade as well.
Well, you mentioned the market attacks, and I think people think of that as something that increases insecurity from violence, but also, does that affect food security? Are people afraid to go to the markets to buy food?
It will affect, you know, the flows through the market. The market we saw wouldn't have the same crowd, because people assembling in large numbers, unfortunately, seem to be the target. So it does generate fear.
That was Mary Ellen Magroarty. She's the World Food Programme Country Director for Chad, and was speaking to Ricky Shryock from N'Djamena. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and/or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis recently took his message of religious tolerance to Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss interfaith solutions to combat religious intolerance and extremism. That's next time on VOA Africa.